Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
So delighted to say Andy Lee is in studio, and on the line is a man he knows very well and has worked with in the past, and we're delighted to have him with us. Adam Booth, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. How's everything?
Very good. Andy has just promised there to grill you, so I'm looking forward to this.
The shoe is on the other foot.
What's my phone signal drop?
Yeah, we'll know if you hang up after a tough question what's happened here. So do you two keep in touch as a matter of interest? Has that relationship continued beyond working together?
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, we're in touch, I'd say, weekly. We'll start off with an initial how are you keeping, what's going on, and then we'll just always kind of fall back into reminiscing. If there's some certain date of significance coming up, we'll remember it. And just a huge appreciation. And from my side, a huge amount of gratitude for all that Adam did for me in the end, towards the end of my career.
How long in the end did you two work together for?
We started in 2012, the end of 2012, all the way up to the end of my career.
Okay. I have a quote from you, Adam, about working with Andy, where you said, "When I first started working with him, I even said it to him. I thought, I don't know how to work with this guy. I don't know if I can do anything for him. The way he moved, the way he held himself, the way he approached things, it's not what I'd worked with before. Wasn't necessarily what I thought the best way was," which is kind of an interesting start to a relationship.
Yes, and an eye-opening one for me as well, because it made me realise in a very sort of quite a dramatic way that it's not the guys that you look at and immediately think, yes, that's the fella that can make a level. There's so many facets to this sport that it's not just what you see on the outside, but the vast majority of it is what goes on inside the fighter's mind. And that's the one thing that I've learned from Andy more than anyone else.
Adam, just like if you were to design, like to build your perfect boxer, your ideal boxer from the ground up, what would be the things you would look for?
Balance, speed, a natural sense of timing, and an intensity, a tenacity, if you want, you could call it spitefulness, but something like that, that shows out relatively quickly.
I guess I didn't have any of that.
You said you're going to grill me, and now you're putting me on the spot in a different way. It's not, I mean, you asked me to design the perfect fighter, and if I was to point to a perfect fighter, I would still point to a combination of fighters. I wouldn't necessarily point to one.
Yeah.
You know, I'd probably point to a fusion of somebody like Leonard and Durant or something like that. Because the perfect fighter, physically and technically, you know, we call Muhammad Ali one of the greatest of all time. But technically, as a fighter, he never threw a body shot, couldn't really punch that well, never really set himself to punch hard, kind of flicked his fist out more than actually drilled them out. You know, with Ali, you could pick out so many technical flaws, and yet it just all worked for him because of what went on inside the man.
Mm.
And so, you know, desire, the tenacity, the will, the strength come through adversity on a daily basis or in the gym, not just in fights, has to be there. That strength of desire and tenacity has to be there. And that's where most people kind of get found out, right? Because when it's all going your way, anyone can look $1 million. It's the guys that don't get it all their own way that still prevail that are the ones that have really proved their skill. And I'd say that that's what you did more than anyone I've known. Because it wasn't like, we can say it now, right? You're a right-handed southpaw, which means that your left hand was always going to be lagging behind to a great extent because you were right hand heavy. Tall and slim, boxed very upright for the vast majority of your career. And so there were things that you and I think that we felt needed working on to allow you to be able to be successful at the higher level. And I thought we did it really well. But ultimately, it was working on those things that allowed you the comfort to be more comfortable when it wasn't going your way, knowing that you would find your position. And the best example I can give to that is the Matt Korobov fight, where we knew what type of fight it was going to be. And as long as you kept dropping low in those exchanges, you were going to come up with something.
When you talk about working on things, how painstaking is that?
It's painstaking because it's what we choose to do.
Sure, but I mean, how difficult a process is it? Something that you can sort out in a week? Is it like the kind of thing where under pressure fighters will always fall back into their habits? It's almost like a signature. It's very difficult to change.
That varies from fighter to fighter. I've got one fighter in my team now who you tell him to do something and he'll do it immediately.
Right.
But what concerns me is the easy come, easy go. If a guy has to strive and fully understand what he's doing to rectify little habits day in, day out, until you break through that margin of, oh, okay, now I'm getting it, it seems to stay ingrained into their habits more.
Andy, were you painstaking day by day?
Yeah, definitely wasn't the first time around, but
I guess you'd worked for so long with Emmanuel, it was just probably in your DNA at that stage.
Yeah, and but it comes from the repetition, like, and it do, for me, it did take a long time. It did take a long time for it to break the habits that I'd built up, and also to adapt physically to the training, and then to use those tools in a fight. And actually, like as you said, when your back's against the ropes and punches are coming at you thick and fast, to have the, those instincts, that for those things that you've worked on to become an instinct, I guess. Adam, just go back. You talked about, I remember even talking about what makes a good fight, and you said spitefulness. But you know, that was something that we worked on intently a lot of the time, talking about having a different mindset entering the ring, you know, becoming a different person almost coming into the ring. You've said it before that training is 80% physical, 20% mental, and in the fight it's the reverse. So what to your mind, what do you think a fighter needs, or what should a fighter's mindset be going into a ring?
One of no doubt, one of total conviction in what they're going to do, and one that exists in its subconscious as much as possible, and that the only information you need in a fight while that 3 minutes is going on is what your eyes pick up. It doesn't matter what you hear, taste, feel, or smell. None of that matters. All that matters is what you see, because if you're not paying attention to any of the other senses, it means the information will go into your subconscious that much quicker. And we are talking about thousandths of a second for that. We call it instinct. But instinct is rehearsed responses. And they exist in our subconscious because of the repetition. People call it being in the moment. There's so many different phrases used. I like to think of it as being in your subconscious, where you don't have any conscious thoughts. Just be reacting to what you see and trusting the process that you've been through thousands and thousands of times, and believing that whatever you get presented with visually, you will have the automatic response to deal with.
Adam, where did you, I mean, the way you talk about being in the moment there, are they your own theories? Have you read about this? Or how have you come to these kind of conclusions? Is it just through experience? Because you talk about it with a real sense of certainty.
It's what I just sit and I think all the time. I'm always questioning what I do, why I do it. Does it work? Just because we're winning, are we doing the right thing? Or just because we had a loss, did we do it wrong? I'm always questioning and thinking. And it's that process that helps me narrow down my own understanding. And then once I've narrowed it down, I question it some more. And then my job is to impart the message that I want to get across to my fighters, where they understand it using as few words as possible. And so I'm always trying to refine how I get my point across to them, and in doing so, develop my own conviction in it. And I guess that's why it comes across the way that you just said it did.
I was reading about your beginnings. So amateur boxer, won 40 or 48 fights, played some football too. Your participation in sport pretty much changes after a football injury, and there's no real way back. I read then you did shifts in the Fitzroy Boxing Club in the evenings, and you worked as a lecturer in anatomy and physiology. A lecturer in anatomy and physiology sounds like a more secure, stable pursuit than doing shifts at the Fitzroy and trying to make it as a boxing coach. Did you target becoming a boxing coach? Where did money or security, or were you somebody with a plan, or like, has this all transpired as you dreamed and hoped, or has it just been kind of, you know, one decision after another and suddenly you're here?
Exactly that. It was never by design.
Right.
I enjoyed teaching. I never finished school. I never took my exams. So to go back and lecture to university graduates in anatomy and physiology was a real challenge and one that made me grow as a man, because here I was having to articulate and answer questions to people much more academic than me. And that helped. That helped. That shows out now in my coaching, or it certainly feels like it does, because if I can't find a way, if somebody doesn't understand what I'm saying, I can find different ways of explaining the same point. But in terms of structuring a career, no. I used to go down the Fitzroy Lodge and take guys on the pads because I missed the gym and I wasn't going to box anymore. Mm. And so the next best thing was putting on the pads and taking people on the pads, because you move around like you're boxing, and it's the same dance. It's just that your hands are getting hit rather than your head and your body.
Mm.
And so I would indulge the sort of love for the physical poetic of a sport, so to speak. I used to enjoy moving and shaping up and reading people's punches and saying, well, if you do that and do that, it might get better. So I was in my mid-20s and I enjoyed it. And it just went from there. Even when I was doing that, I never had any plans to be a coach.
Mm.
But it just, when fighters used to come back and want to do more with me, and all of a sudden it became a hobby that then became a job.
And when you went back to lecture in anatomy and physiology, did you have to go back to school yourself then in your 20s, or how did all that come about?
Yeah. Well, I went away and studied a course on training and sports massage and injury rehabilitation. And I ended up being a sports masseur and a personal trainer, and then ended up teaching it actually for the organization that I studied with. And it was just the reason why I went and studied is because I just wanted to be a personal trainer or a sports masseur. I wanted to do something like that rather than being stuck in an office.
And so did you just, you jacked in school, didn't like school, didn't finish your exams, wasn't for you kind of thing?
Oh, I was only ever going to be a boxer or a footballer, so it didn't matter. Nothing else mattered, right? I remember, because my parents were always away working. I can vividly remember the day of my economics exam. I was sunbathing in the garden and just pretended to be my brother when the school phoned up. I just didn't care. It didn't mean anything to me because it was only ever going to be football or boxing. I just hadn't decided which one at the time.
Wow.
I got away with it, I think.
Yeah.
Just say, like, from that beginning of never intending to become a professional coach to going on to a guy who's trained 3 world champions, 2 of them unified champions, what would you say is the biggest lesson you've learned in your time?
No, there are many different answers to that, but an answer that always keeps coming up is in two parts, that we can't control free will. As much as we may want somebody to do what we want them to do, they might not do it. We cannot control free will, but we do our best to guide them. Those that do not listen must feel.
Brilliant.
They're the two things I would say I've learned.
So is it your job to make them feel if they're not listening?
No, if they don't listen to me, they're going to feel it when someone puts it on them.
It's a more physical kind of feeling then, okay.
Yes. Adam, move your head after your punch. Take low exits. Low is the safest position to be. Don't pull out upright. Say it 1,000 times. You pull out upright, you get killed by a shot. Don't come back to me looking for the answer. I've already given it to you 1,000 times. You didn't want to listen. Mm. Now you feel it. It's that. And I trust me, that's always going to be the case.
Can you give us some more of those? So I get you, Andy almost half nodded that he's heard that a good few times.
Oh, I'm just in total agreement.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You're in agreement. Okay. Yeah. What are the other Adam Booth bullet points that you've said 1,000 times when it comes to just boxing basics if someone's going to fight with you?
Low exit.
Yeah.
The more you want to punch, the more you have to. If you want to punch more, you've got to do more of the other stuff. So more feinting and more taking your head out as well. If you want to punch twice in a round, then you still got to make sure that each shot is unpredictable and have your exit. If you want to punch 200 times in a round, you've got to make it 200 times more unpredictable and take 200 times more exits.
Mm.
It's not just about being busy with your hands.
What tends to separate like someone like Andy who comes in, or obviously you work with Hay from when he was a teenager in the late 90s, are there just certain physical things they have, be it quick hands or they see things quickly? Is there a certain point or two which just physically you kind of need, as well as the spitefulness and the attitude and the hard work?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I do know, even fighters that don't appear to be, aren't known to be punchers or whatever, all world-class fighters have a sturdiness about them, a physical, mental, and emotional sturdiness, a physical, mental, and emotional composure in those critical moments. They just give a different energy. There's no panic. There seems to be no angst, even when things aren't going their way. It's almost like, okay, well, this is part of the script. Yeah, this part isn't supposed to go my way, but ultimately it will. It's almost like that blind belief that they're going to win. There's that sturdiness about them that sees them through.
Andy, something strikes me as we listen to Adam. He seems like a difficult man to disagree with.
Yeah, and I've said it before about Adam. Like, his nickname is the Dark Lord, but he certainly is, he's like a cult leader. And Adam, like, and I'd say it about you, he inspired such like loyalty and devotion that you become like to be around him, you're almost like a disciple. And it's because, as I said, like a lot of boxing coaches will tell you to do something and you ask them why, and they kind of fumble the answer and this is the way it's always been done. But behind everything Adam does, there's a reason and there's a method, and you can keep going, you can keep pushing for the answer, or keep pushing the question, why? And every time you ask why, he'll come back with the answer. And it'll always be interesting.
Yeah. Well, because I asked you about the fighting on instinct, Adam, and I asked you, how did you come around to that conclusion? Did you read it? Did you ask someone? Did you experience it? And you said, I've thought about it. So are you just sitting around thinking a lot of the time?
All the time. When I was younger, when I was at school, I used to be a daydreamer. Just always used to be a daydreamer. I used to imagine that I was a certain footballer or a certain player, and I'd always just daydreaming about stuff. And what I've managed to do is convert that habit into a way of life. Because now I go about my days daydreaming about, why does that fella move that way? Why does he throw the punch that way? Why does he always asking why? And I just walk around all day thinking that, and then try and figure out the answers in my own words to answer it for myself. So if I was asking me the question, I would have the answer.
To get away from all this metaphysical esoteric thing, on a practical, I know, like about over a year ago, you've moved to a vegan diet. I know it's impacted your life, because when we lived together, we were just eating egg whites and chicken breasts. Well, how would you subscribe to a fighter, the vegan diet?
No, because I don't know whether that would have a positive or a negative effect on them, because I don't know. I'm not going to mess with it. And they've just, you know, they've watched documentaries that I've watched, and they listen to what I talk about it, and they all understand it, but I insist that they don't change what they're doing. If they want to be vegans, do it after you finish being a fighter. It's too much of a risk, because we don't know. It may well have a positive effect, but we don't know, so I'd rather not make the change.
Do you feel any different?
Yes, if anything, I feel a lot more calm.
Okay, interesting. You mentioned you live together, and you're not the only fighter who seems to have lived with Adam Booth. So this isn't a, I'll teach you how to fight and then we clock off at 5 o'clock kind of relationship it seems that he has with fighters. Certainly it's not the one you two had if you're living with him.
Yeah, Adam, is that I know it might have been, it was a conscious decision, but it also kind of happened the way it fell between us, but is that a conscious decision by you to have a lot of the fighters spend a lot more time with you? Or, like, certainly most of them live with you for periods of time.
No, it's your fault. It's your fault, because you were the first one that created that habit in me.
I know.
Because I remember standing near the door of my kitchen, just inside the kitchen, in the January of 2014. And we said, right, and you were living in that rented accommodation, and we said, right, let's give this a shot for 6 months. Let's give you an opportunity at light, middle, and middle. If nothing happens, walk away knowing that we did everything we could. I remember that conversation vividly. And from that conversation, 2014, you moved in. That was in the January. And then was it in the May you fought John Jackson?
Yeah. Frank Carter in between. And now, what is it? 4 years later, you've got about 6 fighters left.
No.
The washing machine's very busy.
Belfast, right?
Yeah.
No one lives with me full-time now, how you were. But Ryan will stay for training camps, and Josh will stay a couple of times a week. Michael has his own place because he's got his family with him. So it's not like that. But I wouldn't change for the world. They were great times, you know, and we had big Richard with us as well. And we made memories, didn't we? We did things that we can now talk on radio about and just indulge ourselves because, as you know, I remember you eating Ribita.
I know. Egg whites, two egg whites and Ribita.
Two egg whites and Ribita for breakfast.
Breakfast. No bother.
And that's what it was. Like that, you moved in, so I knew exactly everything you were eating so that you could have that stability that you needed. To make all those tiny little sacrifices, like no toast and butter. They're the things that people don't realise. They're the sacrifices that are the hardest things because they're the ones that habitually you've done for your whole life.
I guess
get a toast and butter with a cup of tea.
I guess the reason I was asking the question, how important do you feel it is to know a fighter as well as the person? And how does that inform how you train them?
Well, the two are the same. Right? You're the fighter you are because of the person you are. And the more a coach can understand the man they're working with, the more they can help them when it's needed, whether that's technical, physical, or in the heat of the battle, when you understand them enough to know what makes them tick and know what will steer them in the right direction and not spook them at a difficult moment in time. And that's where you just become your own little perceptive psychologist, because what you might say in one scenario, you could be presented with exactly the same scenario with a different fighter, but what you say or do or encourage can be the complete opposite. And that all depends on knowing. It's like a trainer of a racehorse. They know every little habit of the racehorse, don't they?
So you get very invested in them as people is the point. So then here's a question for you. You're a smart person. You've seen the damage boxing can do to people long term. You've seen the punishment fighters take. Emotionally, are you detached from the fact that these people that effectively you kind of have grown to love and, you know, there is a kind of love going on here, watching them get hurt?
What's the question? Do I detach myself from it?
Can you detach yourself? Do you ever have misgivings about your involvement in the sport?
Yes. I can't detach myself from it. It'll be a sad day, the day that I can. And then I won't be the coach that I am. So,
do you get emotional? Do you get upset watching certain fighters take punishment?
At the time when it happens, we're in the moment, we're doing what we do. I get more angry than anything. I get angry with them because it's their fault that they're in that situation. They knew that they don't have to be in that situation. So there's that initial sort of frustration and anger. But obviously, it's horrible. I mean, like when Andy walked back at the end of the first round against Peter Quillin, I remember walking up the steps with this empty feeling in my stomach, genuinely believing that the fight was over because I'd already 80% made my decision that I was going to stop the fight in between rounds. And I was talking to Andy, and 15, 20 seconds, there was nothing. He wasn't speaking to me, wasn't really reacting to me at all. Probably with about 10 down period left, I said something to him. He just fixed his eyes on me and just said, "I'm okay, I can get a grip of this." And he stood up, he looked sturdy, and that how he came back from the position he was in the end of that first round to actually starting to control the fight in the second round was incredible, because it was all so very subtle in how it shows out. But it just proved what Andy was and why he had that success.
Well, to quote you back to yourself, you can't control free will. So Andy Lee is going to fight regardless of whether you're his coach or not. So in that sense, it's out of your hands. At the same time, do you ever think to yourself in the coal light of day, God, am I complicit in hurting people I'm so fond of? Or do you park that away somehow?
No, I can't say I think of it like that.
Yeah.
I can't say I think of it like that. If anything, if I was looking at that, if I'm fond of them, I want to do what I can to protect them and not trust anyone else to do it. So, no, I wouldn't say it bears out like that. But we know that when a fighter goes into a hard fight, when they come out of that fight, they're not the same person that went in before. And you just keep adding that up. You got to, especially in today's, it's frustrating and a bit upsetting, because in today's social media society where everyone's got an opinion, just a throwaway opinion that they have no experience or real knowledge of, but they're just publicly putting it out there. The disregard for what fighters go through is offensive to see, and so I just don't look at it anymore.
Just to go, just before we finish up, Adam, Ryan Burnett confirmed yesterday or today, World Boxing Series. What do you think about that? What's going to be your approach? It's a pretty tough, stacked competition.
Yeah, well, this is Ryan's window of opportunity to secure himself as an individual and to secure his boxing legacy and to secure his family. You had this window of opportunity as well. Remember when you had that Matt Korobov fight, and there was Matt Korobov, and then there was Peter Quillin, and then Billy Joe Saunders, right? Look at add up the records of the fellas that you fought in those three fights. Add those records up alone, and it makes, you know, heady reading. And Ryan's in that situation now where he's got these real competitive fights, but he's going to be rewarded for them. I don't ever encourage a fighter to go into a situation that I don't believe he can win. And I've encouraged Ryan to take this series because I believe, as a developing fighter, because he's only had 18 pro fights, I still believe we're to see the best of Ryan Burnett. And yes, he can win this tournament. I see, as much as people are lording up all these other fellas because they look fantastic, I look beyond that and I look at their vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. And I can see Ryan taking advantage of them. But I'm excited about it. And you know what Ryan's like. As soon as he fixes his mind on something, he just believes he's going to win.
Yeah. Well, I can't see any of them have gone through two fights or any adversity like he has in his last two fights. So he's definitely in with a shout of... Not even with a shout, but he's definitely one of the favourites to win. Adam, what people don't know about you, and you're obviously, to me, I don't want to like keep blowing smoke up your ass, but you're the best coach in world boxing, to me. And that was the reason why I wanted to come to you after Marion Stewart passed away. Outside of the coach, you've guided people, me personally, and I know Ryan and I know other fighters, the management side of it. How do you navigate the world, you know, the complicated world of professional boxing, when the only thing that's professional about it is the name? So what do you think about that? How have you handled and like gotten through that world and come out the other side, so to speak?
In terms of all the tricky little moves that people do to disadvantage you financially and with opportunity so that they advantage themselves as much as possible. That's everyone is I was fortunate that through the career of David Hay, I wasn't just a coach, I was a manager and a promoter. And so I got to see it from bottom to top. I dealt with Sky Sports, I dealt with international TV rights, I dealt with it all. But inherently I'm a coach, but I'm a coach that's been fortunate enough to see every step in contracts with Bong King, with the Klitschko's. You know, I've had to deal with many contracts, governing bodies, TV rights and everything. And because I've seen it and I understand the food chain and the pitfalls, it enables me. The first time down was very stressful, and I had many sleepless nights, David Hay's career, making sure or believing that we wanted to make sure we didn't make any mistakes. Gone through David. The second and third time round is a bit easier.
Yeah, I saw you say that you've walked out of meetings before and gone to the toilet halfway through and thought, hold it together, sunshine.
So you've done some good research there. That was one specific occasion.
I presume I know the answer to this. It was kind of intimated in your answer. The boxer is pretty low in that food chain that you talk about.
It's the flow of money. It's the flow of money and understanding, you know, value. And like I said, Don King says your value is whatever you negotiate. Right, you get your worth what you negotiate.
Yeah.
And so, and I do believe sometimes I've over negotiated fighters' positions and been able to get away with it, but more for the other people. I also feel that it's an ever changing landscape. I do believe that boxing is different now. I appreciate Eddie Hearn because we all have our opinions of what the typical boxing promoter is, but I have had agreements with Eddie Hearn for significant fights. And agreed the money, never had anything in writing. And the Monday after the fight, the money that we verbally agreed was in the account. And it's very difficult to put a value on that type of honesty in this business. So as much as people call Eddie the silver spoon and saying he's got an ego, I appreciate him because the one thing he is honest. Mm. He says he's going to give you something, he'll give it to you.
Mm. I had just one last question, and you've been so good with your time, but it occurs to me, given that you're a football fan as well, you'll probably get where I'm coming from. Quite often in football, you'll say that a lesser team might beat a better team because they had better tactics and they were a better coached team, they knew what they were doing more, and ultimately, you know, it was a tactical win. Are they rare? Do they happen in boxing? Have you gone into fights with lesser fighters on paper and you've out-tacticked the other side, or does generally the better man come out on top?
Happens all the time in boxing.
Okay.
You can see a much more technically adept and physically capable fighter fighting someone that just keeps walking forward with their hands up, trying to let that fella make the mistakes to give them the opportunity. And eventually they keep landing enough sort of half-decent shots to nick the fight.
Mm.
So it can happen all the time in boxing.
And is there one where you thought to yourself afterwards, geez, I did pretty well there from a coaching tactical point of view?
Probably, I don't know, because I've been fortunate, the fighters I've worked with have been technically competent. But I'd say that the biggest technical challenge in a fight probably was George Groves against James DeGale. Because at the time, everyone was lording up James DeGale as being the next great thing in world boxing. And nobody gave George a prayer. But I just believe that James DeGale needed a certain set of circumstances to be successful. And all George Groves wanted to do was take his head off. And that would have played into James's hands. And it was firstly mentally getting into George's head that we were going to play a game of cat and mouse. That was the best way of disarming him. And then George eventually nailing it in training and having the belief in it on fight night. I'd say that was one of my most tactically satisfying nights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine.
But I'd also say Andy against Matt Korobov, not just because he's there in the studio, because we knew that Matt, you know, the way to defuse Matt Korobov was a bit similar to Groves the Gale. Messing up his distance, and although you might be losing close rounds, trust the process.
So messing up his distance, as in staying away from him or getting up close to him?
Oh, Andy can answer this one.
Close enough, but at a reach. Stepping away.
Stepping away. Okay.
One little step every time. Yeah, and let him fall short. Okay. But it was, Adam said, I was 6-1 underdog for a reason in that fight.
And you have to work in training on judging that distance. I guess that's the key.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and how do you do that? He smacked you a few times.
Adam on the pads. Okay. Pad work. Yeah. And then in sparring, but pad work.
Right, okay.
And mentally rehearsing it. Adam all the time speaking to me and drilling it and reminding you.
Yeah. Listen, Adam, thanks so much for your time. I think we've probably gone way over, but it's been fascinating having
you
on.
Thank you so much.
No, my pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you very much.
Andy, we'll speak soon as well. Keep
Talk
the video
soon,
coming.
Adam. I will do.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.